Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
Chuck Dallenbach is tuba player and mastermind behind the Canadian Brass, and we speak with him today on Crossover. Hello.
Hi, Jill.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi.
Hi. I feel like I know you. I've been listening to you and your group for so many years.
Excellent.
You sound a kind of far away.
Well, like, I'm in Canada.
Yeah, that's much better. But you're not in the Maritimes. So.
No.
You've been around for a very, very long time, you and your group. And so much has happened with the group, I guess, in terms of expansion that I guess we want to talk about it a little. Somehow, I always think about the Canadian Brass with quirky performances. I don't know, but you have a marvelous new album, so let's discuss that a little bit.
Okay. Well, we have been around for quite a while. We started in 1970, and I think we hold some kind of a record at this point. Not one that we probably will like to delve into for a few years, but we have quite a longevity. And our reputation at first, the buzz around Canadian Brass was that we had a very unique presentation style. And for us, it was very simple. We had music that we loved and an audience that was not that familiar with brass, and we knew that we needed to bring the audience along with us in terms of what we loved about the music and what we thought was interesting. So we simply relayed that to the audience. We started talking to them and with them, and from that became a presentation style that now I think it's almost obligatory on the classical music stage for conductors and artists to somehow share their information with their audiences.
In other words, you mean speaking during the performances and so on, introducing
yes,
what they're doing?
We always thought the time between pieces of music was an opportunity to do something unique. We never messed around with music. When we play Bach, we play serious Bach as a string quartet might. But when we had the awkward in-between parts, we thought, well, what a great opportunity to just tell people what we're up to. So the game was on.
Well, now, what was the original size of the group, the very, very first group that started?
Well, Canadian Brass has always been a quintet. We inherited the form. I think in the late 40s, the form was sealed. The Chicago Brass Quintet, which was the Symphony Guys, which in fact were many of our teachers.
Yes.
And the New York Brass Quintet, which was a freelance ensemble in New York. They both started about the same time, and they set the two trumpet, French horn, trombone, tuba standard that we inherited. But what we didn't have was a professional path, a way to, like a pianist knows exactly what repertoire they need to play to have a career for the next 40 years. Brass quintets didn't, and that was our challenge, to take this form and breathe life into it so that we could then earn our living playing the music that we loved.
Were you ever criticized for transcription?
At first, not at all, and in the middle, yes, and at this point, no. I think there's that wonderful point when you're becoming well enough known that you attract criticism, and then people look for things to talk about. But we made a point in our new Bach album that Bach himself, one of the pieces that we play is a Vivaldi Bach, where Bach took a work by Vivaldi and altered it very little and then made it his own. So we thought if Bach can do it, well, I guess we can make our attempts.
Now, are we talking about the Legends album?
Legends, similarly, is great music from the Renaissance and so forth that, by and large, are transcriptions.
Right. Well, aren't all of your works pretty much transcriptions?
No, we've actually been behind the scenes perhaps a lot. We've been very active commissioners of contemporary music. Of course, we grew up with people that became composers, some of them well-known, and colleagues at universities and one thing another, we've commissioned over 80 major works, meaning more than 10 minutes in length, absolutely blank piece of paper commissioning a composer and saying, okay, you know, have at it. The most important ones would be Lucas Foss, who wrote three pieces for us.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Schickele, who not only did P.D.Q. Bach for us, but did some actual Peter Schickele serious music for us.
Yes.
And Michael Kamen, who is a graduate of the Juilliard School and found his fame in the Hollywood world. He wrote the backgrounds for over 70 major films. But the last piece that he wrote right at the end of his life was a very beautiful, touching, very much like the Barber Adagio, a piece that he simply called Quintet that he wrote for us. So that's always been our constant companion, is encouraging composers and commissioning. But for a main stage Carnegie Hall type presentation with 3,000 people present, I think we really reverted back, and not even realizing at the time, we reverted back to what had been the classical recital kind of concert back in the 30s and 40s. My mother talked about hearing John McCormick, the great tenor,
yes,
in a very small little town, and of course he sang opera excerpts, but he also sang folk songs and everything else, and it was always a mixture. Somehow this changed in the 50s and 60s, and we were supposed to, if we were going to go to a string quartet, then we're only going to hear Bartok tonight.
Right.
And a brass quintet. We just couldn't survive with that kind of stricture. The music doesn't support it. We don't have that kind of music.
I must tell you that I, again, have just listened to the Legends album. That's the one that I had received. And I was just so taken by the arrangements, by the reinterpretation, the whole concept of some of these works that we just take for granted to be played a certain way. The Adagio, mm-hmm. certainly the Barber Adagio, is absolutely breathtaking.
Beautiful.
And the Queen of the Night aria just knocks your socks off.
Isn't that amazing?
It is unbelievable.
Ryan Anthony plays the solo on that, and he's presently, what we did with this recording, I'll just back up one step. We expanded, the Canadian Brass is a brass quintet, five of us, and it always has been, but we expanded for this recording to 10, and we brought back many of the luminaries that have played with us.
Yes.
And one of them is the Queen of the Night, Ryan Anthony, who right now is the principal trumpet in the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. But we keep a very short
leash.
leash. Yes. So we keep him very close to us. He's one of the fine members, really a valued colleague. So we try to dream up ways to keep all of our friends and colleagues involved.
I have to tell you that anyone who has not heard this album will be absolutely blown away. It is so, so impressive. The beauty of the sound, first of all. Mm-hmm. And then again, as you say, you have various complements, we should call them. You have a quintet and a double quintet.
Yes.
And then the full ensemble. And a conductor, is that right?
Yes. It actually leads off with the Copland fanfare.
Which is unbelievable. It always is unbelievable anyway. But the way you play it, it is just devastatingly
fantastic.
Beautiful.
Fantastic. Thank you. It was a sort of thing that we, you know, one day I was contemplating this recording, and it struck me that why have we never recorded the Copland? It's an original composition by a major American composer for brass. Not a transcription. We better get this down. So that was why we took that on as a project.
What an opening, let me tell you.
Great, thank you.
And then, of course, all the way down to the Beatles, Penny Lane, which is kind of cute. Very cute, and probably not so cute to play. I think all of them are very virtuosic.
Well, we ran into the fellow that did the original Beatles performance. His name was Mason in London, England. He was a freelance trumpet player at the time. And when you listen to the original, the trumpet part is exactly what you hear here, but it's very short. And he had the opportunity to record and re-record an overdub. And when he heard us play it, and we were most eager, of course, to play this in front of the fellow that actually did the original, he came up and he said to Ryan, he said, Boy, am I glad you weren't around when I was asked to play this. When I did it, it was only seconds long, and now it's a whole virtuosic piece.
Well, all of them are. They all are really so stunning. Again, very fine, you know, performance, and of course the taste that you show, and the sensitivity, and you play some of the William Byrd, which is mm-hmm. very, very famous,
right.
And the Monteverdi is also very beautiful. The quality of the sound, the tuba, the trombone, the richness of the sound, the recording is amazing, and I think anyone who will listen to it will certainly, just be transported. So this is the most recent that you've done, is that right? Or
it is. And one of the genesis for this, I think you alluded earlier to the fact that we're well known for maybe hijinks on the stage.
Exactly.
That really represents a very small part of what we do in a given concert, maybe 10 minutes out of a two-hour program. But of course, what people are going to talk about, and we encourage them to do so, you know, they really remember the visual and the fact that we get out of our chairs and actually have some fun. But we really are all classically trained musicians. We went to the Eastman and the Juilliard mm-hmm. school. These are schools where you're taught Berlioz and Beethoven and chamber music courses and so forth. So we come by this honestly, and we really approach the performance on our instruments as any legitimate string quartet. We used to like to feel we were modeling ourselves after the Cleveland or the Juilliard string quartet.
Not a bad model.
Exactly. We always thought, don't aim low and succeed.
Well, so I have to say, anyone that's played in an orchestra knows that the brass section is always horsing around. So I think the instruments are naturals for that.
Well, when you figure we're taking all this air in and all this air out and air in and air out and air in, it's enervating, and you are poised for action, and especially in an orchestra, the brass player plays very, very little. String players will have a book on a given symphony; it'll have 20, 30 pages in it, and the tuba part will come along, and it's one page.
Well, I can beat you. I'm a harpist.
Oh, there you go.
So.
You know the famous George Eastman story about harpists?
No.
He put all the money behind the Eastman School of Music. His idea was to train musicians for the pits to play for his silent movies. And, of course, talkies came in, and he tried to withdraw his support, but it was too late. And he was quoted as saying he would come to the Rochester Philharmonic, and he was watching the music and people coming in and out and in and out and in and out, and he said, I don't think we really need two harpists in this orchestra. They hardly play at all.
Unfortunately, that's true. I mean, and tubas, well, but tubas are terribly important. They are really marvelous, marvelous instruments. Speaking of which, you're all worth your weight in gold, aren't you?
Yes, indeed.
Gold instruments, my goodness, is there a difference in sound?
Gold makes a little bit, you can play just a touch softer, and maintain the core of the sound, and just a touch louder and maintain the core. It holds the integrity of the sound a little better. It's very, very, very minor amount. I would say that gold, the best part of the gold is that you only have to polish it once a year, where silver you have to polish once a week.
Oh, yes, right.
So.
And they weigh about the same.
Yes, the amount of gold, it's microns of gold. It's a zinc. The process is first a zinc coating, then a silver, and then gold on top of that. And the entire tuba would probably have apparently about 2 ounces of gold on it.
But it is very impressive to hear
very,
that.
Very thin and very beautiful. And it certainly appealed to our vanity. The genesis for that was that our mentor in Chicago was a fellow named Reynold Schilke. Schilke had been in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, but he was also a very important scientist. He'd worked with the U.S. Army and Fermi Labs, the nuclear energy in Chicago. So he had this science side, and he had his own instrument company, and it was his dream to create a consort of instruments, very much like Stradivarius and Guarnerius and so forth. In the string world, you always had a consort, top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to do the same for brass. And we were talking to him about our idea was that we had we were sort of aiming at the golden age of brass, that it just really hadn't happened for brass yet. Orchestras had their heyday in the late 1800s, string quartets 1700s, 1800s, brass is now. And he picked up on the golden age idea and decided that his consorts, the first set of instruments made by one manufacturer, one hand, should be gold-plated. So we got to live out his dream and actually achieve one of ours, and it was quite a wonderful match.
Well, now, one of the very exciting things for me is that you have a woman playing with you now, is that right?
Yes, indeed. A very fine trumpet player from Montreal, and she hit all the bases. It's hard to say no to Manon. She is, first of all, the first woman to play with us, and secondly, she's Canadian, but more than that, she's French-Canadian. So she's in a pretty secure spot, I'd say.
What was interesting, I had read that she, of course, the audition behind the screen, and then she came out and they said, it's a girl. So I thought that was really a cute story. But certainly there are many, many women players now in brass instruments. I think they've always been playing French horn, but somehow now you have a lot of trumpet players and trombonists.
Exactly.
And now you do tour as well, isn't that right, Chuck?
Oh, yes. Agreed.
How many tours do you do a year?
Well, at this point, we're most of our concerts are in the United States. We'll do 40 or 50 concerts a year in the U.S., and then Germany became a very important place for us to play, and of course, for brass players, that's the birthplace of brass was Germany, for sure.
Really?
So we'll do some 20 concerts, up to 20 concerts in Germany. We try to split it up so that we're there maybe a couple times a year. And then Asia seems to come up every, you know, kind of on an every two-year cycle that we're off to Korea or Japan, and now China is starting to become more prevalent.
Yes.
And we went back to China. We were there in 1977. We were
that was the beginning of the opening of the gate.
That's right. Nixon tried to start it, but they really didn't have a relation to see it through. And then Prime Minister Trudeau set up a cultural exchange. And we were the first volley. We were the first group in.
I know the Philadelphia Orchestra went there in 1973, I believe it was.
Did they beat us to the punch?
Let's not go there.
Yeah, right.
But so this was really, really quite, you are very, very busy. Explain again the Germany thing for our audience about the brass. Is it brass instruments were initially invented there? I mean, was that the place where things began for the instrument?
Germany had a very long tradition of using brass as both military and then inside the horns, which started as hunting horns, got into orchestras.
I see.
And the writing became quite complicated and wonderful. And then the valve was invented. A fellow named Stussel is credited with the invention of the valve, which gave us the opportunity to play chromatic scale. And then, of course, all music is open to us. Trombones go way back. They were usually used as an alternate to a voice in choirs. So they have a long, long, long history. But it sort of all came together in Europe, Eastern Europe and Germany. And the music that was created involved these new instruments. But it happened, unfortunately for us as a brass quintet, it happened at an awkward time because the orchestra was hitting its zenith in the late 1800s when the brass instruments had their chromatic possibility. So instead of being immediately a solo instrument, they all got tucked into the back row of the orchestra. So all of the romantic music, Bruckner and Berlioz and so forth, the brass is very important,
very. Mm-hmm.
But it's all in the back row. So we missed that whole era of like string quartets were getting music from Debussy and Ravel and so forth, and we just weren't. We were being tucked into the back row of the orchestras. We don't have any music that comes from that era, and consequently that's why we took a masterpiece approach to playing. We decided that it was more important that people hear great music than something that had been written specifically for us. And we thought, that can take care of itself. But in the meantime, people really need to be exposed to the very finest music possible. So we just took the masterpiece approach and borrowed the very finest music available.
You said stole? No, I really just can't tell you how exciting it is, this album. It's marvelous. The quality, again, the sound is incredible. The arrangements are spectacular, and of course the playing is out of this world. So otherwise,
all music to my ears.
Yes, it is music and wonderful music to ours. And Chuck Dowenbeck, thank you so very much for spending some time with us here on Crossover. Will you be coming to Philadelphia on tour anytime?
Great, Jill. Well, we have played some double brass quintet concerts there with the Philadelphia brass from the orchestra. And one of the fellows there was actually in a program of ours. He was sort of a student. He was too good to be a student, but he was technically a student of ours for a while. And out in the, of course, we were running one summer. So we love to play with these guys, and we're pushing on that idea as we speak. So hopefully we'll be there very soon.
Well, we hope to see you here. And once again, thank you so much, Chuck.
Oh, thanks, Jill.
The best.